Clay, how long will you have bragging rights over Stephon? This is a big win today.
About 364 days. And then that's a daily thing we do, man. We love to shoot against each other. I've never been on a team with someone who shoots it better than me. So it's a privilege to work with him every day. He makes me that much better.
We're going to bring y'all into our huddle.
You are in the Warriors Huddle with me, Bram. Joining me, as usual, our resident insider, the Chronicle's Golden State Warriors beat writer, and a man who quite simply does not enjoy a good hair shirt, Rusty Simmons. What's going on, Rusty?
Oh, I'm doing great because I'm not wearing a hair shirt. I'm in Portland, where actually, if I look out the window, it's dark and gross, but not raining.
You know, what's weird is that my next question was going to be, look out your window and tell me what you see. So it's almost like you're reading my mind, man. Nicely played.
Yeah, I like to get ahead of the game a little bit, and that was my guess, is that you like to talk about weather, and I'd fulfill that for you.
You're like Nostradamus. And do you feel guilty at all about no showing last week, or have you already moved on beyond that? I mean, where are we on the emotional guilt scale?
Oh no, yeah, I don't feel guilty at all. I mean, it's All-Star weekend, that's big time, and the bye just hasn't reached there yet. But I'm trying to grow with you guys.
Yeah, there you go. We'll take that pseudo compliment, real emphasis on the word pseudo. Let's jump in, man. Insider's report. Let's actually take advantage of the fact that we lost you last week to the All-Star game and kind of dig in to what you saw. Here's my first question. How were the Warriors received in Toronto? I would imagine they were seen as superstars, but I'm about as biased as they get. What was the reception?
Yeah, it was interesting. Like last year in New York, I thought that Carmelo would be considered the ambassador. Usually it's the hometown guy, you know, who gets all the hub. And instead, it was Klay Thompson and Stephen Curry who were treated like darlings. And this year, I thought the same thing would happen in Toronto with Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan. And I thought Kobe Bryant would get a lot of love with this being his 18th and last All-Star game. But instead, it was the Warriors. That was the overwhelming majority of the people. That's what they wanted to talk about, was the Warriors, about how well they're playing, about is there any way to stop these guys. If you go up to a table with an All-Star sitting at it and ask a question, it's like they were waiting for you to ask about the Warriors. It was pretty fascinating.
Does that elevate your status at all? Do you kind of walk out with your chest pumped out a little bit because you're the beat writer for that team, or does that not really translate?
No, it doesn't translate at all. It does make my life a lot easier. Like, I've covered All-Star games where Darrell Wright is the only Warrior participant, sure, and all he's doing is the three-point contest, and somehow I have to turn that into two stories a day for 3 days. Having three players who are in the game and part of All-Star Saturday night and the darlings of the event makes my life much easier.
I remember that Darrell Wright year because I was a season ticket holder and they sent me a signed picture of Darrell Wright in the three-point contest, a contest, by the way, that he didn't win. And I remember thinking, who the hell wants this? Like, why do they give this to me? What are they memorializing? His participation? I don't want to bury the lead, though. There is no question in my mind that the Splash Brothers got that kind of attention. Of course they did. You know, not only are they known probably internationally at this stage, but they were in the game last year. So, you know, they've already kind of established themselves as all-stars. How about Draymond? Did he get that same superstar treatment, or was he more of an outcast?
No, he got the superstar treatment. Players went out of their way to tell him to embrace his first time there, and the NBA made sure that he felt like a superstar. I mean, they created an event for him. Not only did they let him be part of the skills challenge, they created a beef with him and Kevin Hart and let him be in his own three-point contest. And then Draymond did his part and wore a yellow banana suit, so he was on TV the entire time Saturday night. I mean, he was a star of the event.
That was one of the most ridiculous jackets I've ever seen in my life. Also, let the record reflect, I am wearing that jacket right now where I'm recording. It makes me feel important.
That goes so well with your hair shirt, so I can see how that would be a great setup.
I wouldn't wear it if I didn't also have my hair shirt on. Let's not be ridiculous. I am trying to start a movement where we all just pretend that the Kevin Hart, Draymond Green three-point contest tie didn't happen. How hard did Draymond take that, man? Because if I'm being honest, it was really obvious that that whole thing was pre-produced, right? They had a trophy that already had his name on it. They already had like this little thing that they were going to do at the end because everybody assumed Draymond was obviously going to win. And then he doesn't win. He ties them. What was Draymond's response to that? Like, did he take it hard or did he not really care?
No, because everybody live at the event, the score was 12-11. Everybody in the arena was under the impression that Draymond won.
What?
Even when people were trying to razz Draymond Green hours after it, when there was some question to the validity of it, Draymond was like, man, I won. Plus, Kevin Hart's toe was on the line on half his shot. So in perfect Draymond fashion, even when he doesn't win, he's certain that he did.
I'll tell you what, I love Draymond Green. I love this team. I certainly don't have to explain why. I've been doing the podcast for long enough for the listeners to know. But if you find yourself in a situation where you have to justify hopefully beating a comedian in a three-point contest, something has gone horribly wrong. Let's not talk about this shady side. Tell me something else. In fact, open-ended question. Give me a story from Toronto that sticks out in your mind.
Well, most of the stories surrounded people complaining about the weather. It was never higher than 8 degrees. But I didn't find that to be a problem because all of the events happened indoors. And to me, Saturday night was a huge success. I think it had been lacking for a while, getting rid of that pop a shot thing that they used to do with one former player and one WNBA player and one current guy. Getting rid of that was a great idea. Adding the big men to the skills challenge, I think, was smart because I think that shows where the game is going.
Especially since one won, right?
Yeah, exactly. And finally, the dunk contest was good again. When they got to the point where they had six consecutive 50s and the guys were just laughing with each other and Levine and Gordon were out of dunks. They hadn't practiced anything else they were doing. And they were still putting up spectacular moves and spectacular dunks. To me, Saturday night was the winner of the event.
So focusing, well, I guess it's not just Saturday night, but which title holds the most cachet for the players in your opinion? Is it the All-Star MVP? Is it the three-point champ? Or is it the dunk contest champ?
You know, for years, I think it used to be the dunk champ. Back in the day, we can all talk about Spud Webb and D. Brown and obviously the Dominique Wilkins and Michael Jordan dunk championships.
Sure, yeah.
Julius Erving.
Or even like Vince Carter or Jason Richardson more recently.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah, those things are indelible images in our minds. And so I think for a long time that dunk contest champion meant a lot. And it's gotten so bad, and they tried different ways to bring it back. And so for all that time, obviously the three-point contest was the big deal. It had the big names in it. It still does with Stephen Curry. But I think Gordon and Levine brought the dunk contest back, and that going forward for at least another little while, that'll be the one with the big cachet.
So it's still the dunk champion. You think the right person was crowned the dunk champion this year?
I don't. But it doesn't matter. I mean, what happened was fascinating. And what will be remembered is that image of Gordon somehow sitting in the air. That's the winner of the event, is that photo. It doesn't matter who took the trophy home.
Oh, well, I mean, Gordon did at least two dunks that I had never considered, let alone seen. One was that one you're talking about, where he went underneath the legs. I'm like, physically, I have no idea how he even thought about doing that. The other was that hoverboard spin dunk where he jumped over the mascot. Just the catch, the one-handed grab of the ball on that, I thought was awesome.
Yeah, he was insanely creative. And I watched the air seat dunk, I don't know, 20 different angles, because I'm certain at some point he has to push off the mascot
to get that high,
defend himself like yep. that. And I can't see it anywhere. I don't see how he did it. So to me, it's just remarkable. It's remarkable even if he did find some way to push off, but I can't find it in video anywhere.
I will give him a little bit of shit about the use of the mascot. Like, all right, you want someone to hop on a hoverboard. That's mascot territory, right? You're not going to get a player or somebody else to spin around. So that was the perfect use of him. And mascot's pretty tall, so it's impressive to go over him. But once you've used the mascot like four times, I started thinking, does Aaron Gordon not have any friends in the league? Is there nobody else in his life who he can ask for help with? You know, I mean, he plays with professional basketball players. There's no way he couldn't have reached out to somebody else.
Well, he did. He did get the decent lob off the side of the backboard from Elfrid Payton.
That's right.
But I think once everybody saw the debacle of Steve Nash trying to do the soccer move in skinny jeans, they were like, "Man, we're not bringing anybody else out here."
How awkward or nothing. How awkward did that make you feel, man? Because I felt so terrible for both of them.
It made me feel terrible. And, like, Steve Nash is a national treasure in Canada. People there were really uncomfortable with it.
I was watching it with my wife, and she asked me, is this a soccer competition? Because she looked up at the last second. It's like, no, but I'm not sure why they're doing this at all. I thought that was awful, man. Tell me about
that point, it was a competition of no kind. It was terrible. Amateur hour that nobody should have to watch.
Well, it was a competition of how can we make you feel more awkward than this, and I think that they won it.
Yeah,
the 3-point.
They made the dude be part of the celebrity game, which was awful, and then they made him try to do a soccer move during a dunk contest in skinny jeans. So, in treating their Canadian icon, I'd say they did about as poor a job as they could have.
I promised myself I wasn't going to ask any questions about the celebrity game, but I can't hold back. Does anybody give a single fuck about the celebrity game? Do people actually watch that?
No, they don't. It's terrible. I went for, I think this was my 9th All-Star game, and I went this year.
Show off.
Because it was told to me that was going to be the easiest place to get in touch with Steve Nash. And he blew off the media at that thing, and I completely understand why. The celebrity game is awful. It's an embarrassment. And I think it's really demeaning that they make the WNBA players play in it.
Sure.
They're better than everyone on the court, and they kind of have to play down the competition and defer because they would dominate the game. To me, it's really embarrassing. It's a bad show.
It's a sexist decision, honestly. It undermines how good how good they are to put them in what is already considered a complete joke. Why the hell would you do that? One, from a personal level, but from a professional one. That's your product. You know, why the hell would you do that?
Yeah, it's awful. And that's just one of the many awful decisions about the celebrity game. I don't know who it's for. The one smart thing they do is they put it in the smallest gym possible in whatever region we're in for the All-Star game. So that's fine. But here's an example of how terrible the celebrity game. Drake's son starts getting in an argument with Kevin Hart during the game. It's the best part of the game that's ever happened because Drake's son is probably 6 or 8 years old as Kevin Hart. So they put a jersey on Drake's son. He walks out on the court. Some ESPN exec comes sprinting out of the stands and says, no, he didn't sign a waiver.
Wow.
So the best thing that almost happened in the game wasn't allowed to happen.
I forgot. So
I didn't realize how worked up I was about the celebrity game. Yeah, I hate
it. It's the most excited I've seen you in the last hour. I mean, I thought you were going to pass out at some point. Now you got the adrenaline going. So I'm happy to see it. Before we get too far from the dunk contest, I did want to ask you this. One of the things I've always loved about watching the dunk contest is the players' reactions after a dunk, right? We always get that front row view. And what's always striking is that when you look back on past dunk contests, the people who are in the front kind of exemplify where the NBA is, right? It kind of gives you a sense of what area it is because you see what players are being featured. My question is, how do they decide who get those tickets, right? This year, Draymond's prominently featured, Steph's up front. We see Andrew Wiggins. Is that something that the NBA decides? Do they hand out those tickets to kind of promote who they think are the new face of the league, or what's behind that, if you know?
No, those guys do not have tickets. Those guys are the Saturday night participants who have decided to get dressed. They usually have somebody help them with what they're going to wear, and they come back out there to be seen on TV. Now, you mentioned a guy like Wiggins, that obviously he was placed by the NBA to be back there. And you're right. A lot of times they'll choose some of the local guys. Wiggins is Canadian. Or they'll choose some up-and-coming guys that they want to be seen on TV.
Okay.
But what I think is neat is the jocularity, the camaraderie that happens. The guys that don't have anywhere to go, don't have any seat, they've just decided – I'm done with my portion of this evening, but I still want to be around hoops, so I'm going to go out and hang out with these guys.
Did you just make up the word jocularity? Was it just on the spot right there, or is that a real word?
Yeah, I just do that. Well,
just yet another reason I'm impressed, man. Who advised Draymond on his jacket? Do you know, was it Prince?
I need to find out. Whoever it was a very bad decision. I know that it was not Andre Iguodala. He was in town only long enough for the players' union meeting. And you'll remember that last year when Draymond was hurt, he sat out a game and wore one of Andre's jackets that had a monocle on it. And I thought that was way cooler than the Inspector Gadget yellow thing that he was sporting.
Do remember that. I remember thinking that he borrowed it from the Monopoly man. So it did stick out of my head. Just a few more questions on the All-Star game, and then we'll flip over, man, to the trade deadline and then predictions for the second half of the season. Here's the first one. What did the three-point championship mean to Clay?
A ton. The whole weekend did in general. Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player of all time, sought out Klay Thompson. And then the three-point contest means the world to Klay. He's happy going along being the Robin to Stephen Curry's Batman. He knows that's good for the team. He knows that's good for winning. He knows that that has brought him success off the court as far as endorsements go. But he's also competitive as can be.
Sure.
And when President Obama at the White House said that Klay Thompson's jump shot is sweeter than Stephen Curry's, Klay just nodded. Like, yeah, of course it is. You know, so he has that competitiveness to him. So he wanted this thing. His dad told him before if he didn't beat him, he wasn't going to take him home. So, this was a family affair. The Thompsons wanted this deal. This meant a lot to them.
What the hell did Jordan tell Klay? I'm not going to let you skate by with just the reference. What happened there?
He told him to go chase 73. And I'm debating, and I'm trying to get Kerr, because Kerr obviously knows Michael Jordan really well. I'm trying to.
Was it a mind game by Jordan?
Yeah, we all know the story about him taking Charles Barkley out, or, you know, whenever he was in a playoff series, he would take somebody out. And his idea was, oh, I'm going to convince him that he's my friend, and then I'm going to go strangle him and score 40 points. So was he really giving him the go-ahead as the next great shooting guard to go chase this thing? Or was he saying, oh, yeah, go ahead. Go get this thing. I'm behind you 100%. And meanwhile, he's ready to knock him out if he comes close.
Don't you kind of hope that it's the mental game? You know, that it fits into that rubric? I much prefer the I will kill you before I lose to you, Jordan, than the gracious loser, Jordan. That sounds terrible to me.
Yeah, that's the Michael Jordan I know. And look, I mean, I look at the last five games that the Warriors play this season, and they've got two against Memphis and two against San Antonio. I don't think the Spurs are going to sign Jordan to a 10-day contract, but the Memphis Grizzlies might. And I think there's a chance that if the Warriors are close to 72-73, that Jordan plays two games for the Memphis Grizzlies.
You heard it here first. I also think Jordan would help the Grizzlies more than Lance Stephenson, but we'll leave that to smarter minds than I. What did the loss in the three-point contest mean to Steph?
Well, right afterward, he said he's not going to do it anymore. I don't know. He usually looks ahead a little bit and would realize that next year is in Charlotte, in his hometown, that they're going to make him be part of every event possible. But I think in that moment, he was saying what he believed. That he wanted to win one bad, and he had a struggle getting it. And then when he finally got one last year, I think he was happy. You kind of have to go defend your title, and so he did this year, and he certainly was trying to win it. But he's the best player in the league, and for him to be part of All-Star Saturday night is a little bit beneath him. So I think he was honest. I think he was saying, look, I'm done.
The losing didn't fire him up, though, just from what I've learned from you about him. That if you're playing ping pong and he loses, he would like to rip your face off. He's the type of competitor we assume from Jordan. So losing to Klay, that doesn't kind of spark the. I mean, I guess you already talked to him and he said he doesn't want to come back next year. So it's a rhetorical question. But losing to Klay didn't spark up the competitive juices for him to want to come back.
And we'll see what Klay does. Klay doesn't talk much, but if he rubs the trophy in Steph's face or mentions it once or twice, you better believe that those competitive juices will start going, and Steph all of a sudden will be like, okay, yeah, I'll be in it next year. And by the way, I'll beat you left-handed.
Kind of like I would do to you in a free throw contest. Let's talk about the look around the league, man. Normally a segment I only use when big things are happening in the NBA. That was kind of true today. Should have been a big day. It was the trade deadline that ran at 3 p.m. Eastern, so we are past it. From my perspective, nothing big happened at all. In fact, there's paint drying somewhere that is far more entertaining than this trade deadline. But any trades that caught your eye, any reasons the Warriors should be concerned?
No, I thought, and I was way off on this. If I'm a Warriors fan, I would have been worried about what Oklahoma City was going to do. They have a ton of assets. They should have an insane amount of urgency that Kevin Durant is about to be a free agent and Russell Westbrook's going to be a free agent in 2 years. I thought they might do something, and they didn't. So if I'm a Warriors fan, I sigh some relief there. The Spurs, as usually, didn't do anything.
Yeah.
The only one who should even be on the Warriors' radar, I guess, is Cleveland. And I think picking up Channing Frye is a smart move. Look, the Warriors have had trouble defending stretch fives. Channing Frye is one of those guys. It gets Cleveland closer to what the Warriors do, but eventually Cleveland, if the Warriors play them in the finals, is still going to have to guard a 1-4 pick and roll with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love, and it's going to be ugly.
Yep, and if the only name that you throw around as reasons why we should be afraid as Warriors fans is Channing Frye, then it was a pretty damn good trade deadline. You know who caught my eye? Not because they represent any kind of threat, but the Clippers trading Lance Stephenson for Jeff Green. The reason I love that is now Memphis currently has Tony Allen, Matt Barnes, and Lance Stephenson all on the same team. If that doesn't result in some kind of like brawl or at least some kind of great story that spills out of a practice, I'll be very surprised.
And soon to have Michael Jordan on a 10-day contract. That is going to be a rock.
And, you know, I keep forgetting about the Jordan edition, man. That's on me. I got to do better. All right, let's finally talk Warriors focus. The Warriors have now played 52 games, meaning that there's only 30 games left. People generally look at the All-Star break as the half line. It's not. You know, it's just a convenient break. But I want to use this as a way to start looking forward. Some overarching questions, some over-unders. Here's my first one for you. Over-under on the Warriors' longest losing streak for the remaining 30 games, 1.5. What do you take?
I'll go over, and that's a perfect number to choose. I can't remember the last time they lost three in a row, and I don't think they will. Steve Kerr has promised us too many times that he's going to start resting guys. They have 6 back-to-backs left. They're not home for the rest of the month. And at some point, they're going to lose a game and then rest guys. And they'll lose 2 in a row at some point.
I'll take the over, too. I kind of feel like, and that was going to be one of the questions I had for you, do you think they'll start resting people? It almost feels like they're in a game of chicken with the Spurs as far as resting people. You know, I mean, I think both the Spurs and the Warriors recognize that home court advantage is going to be a huge factor in their ultimate playoff series, and that both of them want to win regular season games because of that. I also think that they both recognize they got players who could use some rest, and it's almost like they're looking at each other to decide when they can do it, right? Because they don't want to rest players and then lose ground on their biggest opponent, and they also don't want to face that opponent with injured guys because they didn't rest them.
That's exactly right. And they play each other twice in the last month of the season, and they really don't want those games to be playoff games right before they play each other in the playoffs.
Sure.
They'd like to have this thing decided before it gets to that, right? So I think you're exactly right. I think they're looking back and forth and saying, man, would you lose some games or would you rest some guys so that we can do it? I think they're paying attention.
They should Kerr should use his experience with Pop, call him up and say, hey, let's hold hands and do it together. You know, like tonight, we're just going to rest everybody.
I don't think there's any reason why they have to hold hands.
It's more metaphorical. More metaphorical there, buddy. You know, just settle down. Why don't you ask me another couple questions about weather? Nobody wants to hear your takes. All right, next one. Minutes for Bogut. Before Festus went down, Bogut was playing a career low 20.7 minutes, which I thought was phenomenal. Now Festus, and I want to hear about an update from you, but Festus is out. Going forward, over under on Bogut minutes, 20.7.
Oh, it's going to be over for that, for sure. Part of the reason why it's going up is because he just played Dwight Howard. In those games, he's going to play 30-plus minutes. But there aren't a ton of those kind of centers in the league anymore. A lot of times, it's still going to be 20 minutes of Bogut, 15 minutes of Mo Spates, and then 5 or so minutes of Draymond Green at center. So I don't think it's going to go up tremendously just because there aren't a bunch of games against Houston left. Al Jefferson's hurt. Marc Gasol's hurt. They don't see DeMarcus Cousins again. So it's not going to go up tremendously, but he is going to play more minutes while Festus is out.
What's up with Festus? I saw recently that Bob Myers came out, essentially said that, let's see, one, they trust their doctors. Two, their doctors are telling them that Festus is going to come back before the end of the year. So three, they're assuming Festus will be back before the end of the year. Same thing you're hearing?
Yeah, well, Festus talked after practice today and parroted what the Warriors are saying, that he'll be reevaluated in 6 weeks. And with the Warriors, that's usually a scary thing, because the reevaluation at 6 weeks is usually, we'll update you again 6 weeks from now.
Yeah.
But this doesn't sound like a similar thing. This sounds like in 6 weeks, so that'll be the surgery was February 8th, March 21st, we'll get an update. Festus believes that he'll be cleared for practices and scrimmages at that point. If he gets a week of practices and scrimmages, he could be available for, you know, say the last 5 games of the regular season. That's his goal right now.
Okay, get himself back
regular
up.
Regular season games before the playoffs start.
So he gets his wind up and is ready to contribute when they need him. I mean, that's not a small window. Who steps up in his absence? So deadline's passed. They didn't make a move for anybody. You know, maybe we'll see some buyout candidates and what happens there. But assuming the Warriors are standing pat with this roster, who steps up now that Festus is out?
Well, it's got to be Mo Spates. There might be some time, some opportunities there for Jason Thompson. I know Steve Kerr keeps mentioning how bad he feels for James Michael McAdoo because they'd be using him. But
right.
The guy's got turf toe that kept Shaq out 50 games. So
right.
He's already missed 20 and he can't run. So he can't get out there.
What about Looney?
He can help. He's ready to play health-wise. His hip is healed. He's ready to play. It's tough for them to get a rookie on the floor. Plus, I think he's close to a 3 and he is a 5. Yeah. He's a 4. That's where they want to work him in. I think putting him out there, even against a second team center, he'd get abused pretty quickly. So it's got to be Mo Spates right now. And he's been doing fine. You know, it's 2016. He can't even remember what happened in 2015.
How about there were some rumors today that the Lakers might buy out Roy Hibbert? I have no idea.
That's the name.
Let's say that happens. Would you have any interest in bringing him in?
Absolutely. That's the one name. There are, you hit on the exact one. There are a dozen guys who will probably get bought out. To me, Roy Hibbert is the one of interest.
I'm on fire today, man. You've already given me a comment about a good question. This is fantastic. So do you think, give me a percentage, 10%, 80%. What's the chance he comes here?
I'd say it's only a 50% chance that he gets bought out.
Yeah.
And then I think the percentages are pretty good. I'd probably say 70-80% that the Warriors could get him. Because what happens is with a buyout, he's already got that money. He'll go through the waiver process. Nobody's going to claim him because they have to pay the full salary if they claim. So he's going to make it through the waiver process. And then why would you not go to the team that's going to win the championship? You're going to be playing for the league minimum wherever you go. So why not?
You remember at the beginning of the season when he was describing his sought after role for the Lakers is that he literally put it, I want to be the Black Bogut. I want to be the defensive center. You know, I don't want to be asked to score at all. And like, we would be asking him to do exactly that, right? He'd be the backup Black Bogut, but it seemed like it would fit exactly what he wants to do.
Yeah. Now the hard thing is I had this exact conversation with some of the Warriors front office last night. And the hard thing for them is, who do you cut? They've already got 15 guys. You can't sign a 16th. You can't send a guy to the D League and keep his rights. They believe that their core is 11 guys, and then Looney is off the table. So you're basically talking about Jason Thompson, Ian Clark, Brandon Rush, James Michael McAdoo.
It's got to be Jason Thompson, right?
Who is worth it to you to cut? to make that move. Yeah, I mean, to me, that probably makes the most sense. The other guys have some developmental value to
right.
them. So Jason Thompson probably is the guy, but we've seen how difficult it is to pick up both what the Warriors do on offense and defense with all their switching and helping. And Jason Thompson's a smart guy, and if he hasn't gotten it completely in two-thirds of the season, is it really worth bringing in Roy Hibbert
sure.
to try to do it now?
Yeah.
So that's where the tough decision comes in. I think the Warriors will have the option. I think Hibbert would love to come here, but the Warriors got to make that decision.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out, man. Let me give you another over-under. Games coach for Steve Kerr going forward. There's 30 left. That's my over-under for you. Over-under, 30 games.
Ooh, I'm going to take the under.
Yeah.
Why? And my mind has changed on that. He talked so much and so pragmatically about not coming back until he knew that he wouldn't have to miss another game. But the other night, after the Houston game, he kept the interviews, post-game interview, really short. I could tell something was wrong with him. I followed him out in the hall. And as he was waiting for security to unlock the coach's office, he had to brace himself up against the wall because he had headaches and the dizziness was so bad. Now, I think the All-Star break helped. Being in San Diego, 78 degrees, no stress, no basketball, none of that. No long hours, obviously, all that stuff helps, but that's the last break. Now you got a 30-game sprint to the playoffs, and I think there's going to be a time where he's going to have to sit, and I think since he watched what happened for the first 42 games, that he has faith that it's not the end of the world. If he misses a game or has to sit in the locker room for a game or stay in the hotel for the one game, that's not the end of the world. Him being healthy, and just like he tells his players, him being healthy in the playoffs is what matters.
No doubt. Well, him being healthy, period, right? I mean, with something like this, it's got to be terrifying. And then him being healthy for the playoffs, and then finally him being healthy for the regular season would be the hierarchy. If he is having a reoccurrence of symptoms, can you imagine how terrifying that would be if you're him? You know, like you think you got this thing beat. It's got to be it's not a rolled ankle. I mean, we're talking spinal fluid. For this to slowly creep back both into your personal and professional life, if it was me, would be scary as hell. So it doesn't surprise me. I'm with you. I say under two. I don't have the kind of access you do, but just watching on TV, you can see him struggling a little bit more. It almost looks like the bright lights are kind of bothering him a little bit. It seemed like the issue was creeping back up, and I'm unhappy to hear that it is.
Yeah, and you know what? A lot of it is, He came back. I thought he was going to wait until he was 100%. But
right.
if he waited until he was 100%, that might have been never.
Yep.
What he's done is learned how to manage the symptoms. And so it's not so much that something has creeped up or that there's been a setback. It's like he always talks about, there's no peace of mind for him right now because he doesn't know when the symptoms are going to be the worst. And,
sure.
and he's got a toolbox to deal with them, but that's all he's doing. He's dealing with the symptoms. They're all there. It's just a matter of how much can he deal with them?
Right.
How much can he put them off to the side? And I think that's why I think he's going to miss a game. There's going to be a game where it's just not that important. It's not that important for him to risk it, to be out there when he can still manage the team and keep things rolling by doing what he does, the pregame prep, and then turning it over to Luke.
Right, and just like you said, they won 24 straight without him there. You know, I mean, skip 10 games. Get better because we need you for the playoffs. Next over-under. Wins, 72.5. Over-under.
They're going over. They're going after this thing. And,
yeah.
and I don't care how much they rest guys. This team, 11, 12, 15 deep, want this thing. They're hoop heads. They know the history of it. I know that publicly they keep saying the only time they talk about it is when we bring it up in the media, but these guys are talking about it. They want it. They understand history, and they're not scared to chase it. They're going after this thing, and they're thinking bigger. They're thinking dynastic stuff, and they want greatness, and they're going for it.
They're going for the jocular titles?
No, that's totally different things, but yeah.
I was just, did I use that right? I felt like I used it right.
Yeah. not as well.
My guess, 75-7. What's your guess?
73-9.
All right. I bet you a dinner that I'm right.
That your number is right?
That my, well, that you know, my number versus yours. If
I'll bet you a dinner that
all
your
right.
number's not right.
Boom. No. My number versus your number. I'm not locking myself in on that. If they hit 72, you win. If they hit 75, I win. If they do not hit either, nobody wins. Bet?
That's fair enough.
There you go. Major question. Let me get off the over-unders and ask you this. 52 games in, what concerns do you have? What's sticking out as the chink in the armor?
Stephen Curry's ankles.
All right. So injuries, anything else? Or literally that's it, just happenstance. We avoid the normal downsides. We're okay.
Yeah, that's it. They turn the ball over too much. They get lazy on defense sometimes. And what makes their defense so fantastic is the ability to switch everything and to rotate and to make it look like they got eight defenders out there. They get lazy, but of course you would when you're playing against inferior competition every single night.
What about lack of animosity? You know, I mean, because that's what you're like. They are. They're playing against far inferior competition. They haven't really been pushed. You know, maybe two or three games, but not really. Is that something we got to worry about? You know, that they haven't had to find that next gear.
No, because when they get pushed, they beat Cleveland by 30.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yep. when somebody shows up who can actually instill some fear in them, they beat San Antonio by 30.
Yep.
You know. So, when they respect the opponent, they crush them. So I don't know. To me, there's absolutely nothing there to worry about except injuries.
Who's their biggest threat?
Oklahoma City.
Not the Spurs.
No, Oklahoma City has two of the top 10 players in the world. They're deeper than the Warriors, which is amazing to say. They're deeper than the Spurs, which is amazing to say. They're just now learning to play with each other under a new coach, and they're already scary. Their home court advantage, I know the Warriors' history of losing at San Antonio. I know the Spurs haven't lost at home this year, but the atmosphere is not close to Oracle. The atmosphere at Chesapeake Energy Arena in Oklahoma City is similar to Oracle Arena. It is nasty in it. That to me is the team that can give the Warriors trouble.
Maybe I'm just being willfully ignorant. I am not worried about anybody else's roster. No set of players scares me, especially with this new offense that we're running. It feels like, and I've said this before, the West Coast offense that Bill Walsh initially ran, not because of some actual similarity on the court and the field, but because we seemingly have come up with something ahead of the game. Certainly other teams will catch up in a couple of years. Right now, what we're doing is just light years ahead. That's why the Spurs scare me, because they have the only person on earth who may be able to find the weaknesses in this system within a single playoff series, and it's Popovich. You know, if anybody can make an adjustment where suddenly our cuts and the way that we're using Draymond to go 4-on-3 with everybody, no longer works, it's going to be Greg Popovich. So I still think we'd be favored, but they're the guys who just worry me, man. They're always kind of on my periphery.
Yeah, I mean, I think any series that includes Greg Popovich is scary. But when we talk about the Warriors, their number one problem is turnovers. And when you make live ball turnovers against the Spurs, they say thank you, and then they set up their half-court offense. When you do live ball turnovers against Oklahoma City, Kevin Durant or Russell Westbrook shove it down your throat.
Yeah, right. And the crowd now is fired up at Chesapeake Bay. Yeah, well, I guess we'll find out. We got a repeat title here. What's your guess? The Warriors pull it out back to back?
Oh, yeah, they're going to win it, and they're going to win it in a sweep. The East.
Look how confident you said that. You're feeling yourself today, man. Nicely done.
Last year I was worried. I was like, I'm afraid that the West is so good that they're going to beat each other up, and then the terrible East is going to be just sitting there healthy and waiting for somebody to win. This year, I don't even think it matters. Like, the East, who's going to come out of there? Cleveland, Toronto, Chicago, Atlanta, Washington. I mean, who scares you out of that group?
Nobody. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. And I had a fight with Scotty before we hopped on mics today. And unfortunately, and geez, I should have said this far earlier. Scott obviously couldn't join us today, but we'll be back next week. Scott's under the impression that if the Warriors finish this year with more than 72 wins, lose the championship, it will be a successful season. I'm under the impression if they win the rest of these, if they go 78-4 and lose the championship, it would be a remarkably large failure. It'd be like an amazing relationship where the courting period goes phenomenally, you know, everything's great, and then it ends in this flaming divorce, and all you remember is the end, because that's the most defining part. Where are you on that spectrum? If they don't win the championship, but they do set the win record, failed season?
Failure. Yeah, they don't hang banners for regular season titles.
Said even faster than me, although I was kind of happy about my whole relationship analogy. I practiced it once. I kind of rushed it when we were doing it now, but I felt pretty good about it.
Yeah, and you know what? Now that I it was a great line, what I said, but it's actually not true. Chicago did hang a banner that says 72 on it, and it's actually the size of the championship banner. So some people do hang banners for that, but they also won the championship.
Do you know if Chicago hung any banners that use my relationship analogy at all, or no?
I only heard about 3 words of that question.
It wasn't that funny anyways. We'll move on immediately. Last section before story time with Uncle Rusty, worse than wet socks. I got something to bitch to you about, man. It's bandwagon fans. I have no problem with there being more fans. I have no problem with there being bandwagon fans. What I have a problem with is bandwagon fans pretending like they've been here forever. When the first person you can name is Baron Davis and you think that you're going way back, you are still a bandwagon fan. And here's why it's bothering me, man. What this feels like, it feels like 30 years ago, somebody told me that if I waited in line for 3 decades, I could get into the world's greatest club. And for 30 years, I stood there through sleet, through snow, through rain, people coming up and punching me in the face. I couldn't take a shower. I'm just this awful period of time. And finally, after 3 decades, 30 years pass, they open the doors to the club. And right as I'm coming in, hundreds of thousands of people run into the club at the exact same time without having to wait in line. And while we're all in there, we're all enjoying it in the exact same way. And they got to enjoy the club was just as good as I thought it would be, but they get to enjoy it at the same time without having to go through any of the painful walk up. That seems bullshit to me, Rusty. Am I being overly emotional? Give me a real take on that. Is that off base? Should I be happy about this? Or is there some legitimacy there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my feeling on this thing is when a team is this good, there's enough credit to go around. I think there's enough fan support to go around. I think it's fine, man. Just open up the club, let everybody come in there and have fun with you. You know, they're all not going to be wearing your hair shirt. So, you know, they're not going to have the history of the Warriors that you have. They're not going to have the pent up hostility of all the losing years. They're not going to be able to fully enjoy it. I mean, they're going to get some of the players' names wrong. They don't know about Ian Clark and about James Michael McAdoo. It's not going to piss them off that Jason Thompson was at the White House. So you're still going to have your thing.
All right, I appreciate that. What I would like is a hair shirt that says, I've been here for 30 years, and then I'd feel fine. You know, if they didn't pass that out to everybody else, and I'd be okay.
There you go. We solved
Uncle,
that.
Story time with Uncle Rusty. I got what I've been looking forward to. Monte Ellis, take it away.
Oh man, I could tell so many stories about Monte Ellis, from the G to the rated X versions.
Venture towards the X rated.
But I think my favorite story about Monte Ellis that kind of told me a lot about who he is happened in New York. The coaches a lot of times will base the travel on the cities. And if you're in New York, instead of going on to Philadelphia or Charlotte or somewhere else, they'll stay in New York and then go to the next place. Or if they're in Chicago, they'll stay there instead of going to Milwaukee. So the coaches have done the players a favor. They stayed in New York. They're going to practice there before they go on to the next place. And as usual, Monte Ellis is late, and he's taking his time, and he's tying his shoes while everybody else is stretching. And finally, Don Nelson has had enough of it and just gets into him, tells him, you're the best player on this team. You've got to be a leader. You can't even have your shoes tied on time. And for some reason, this infuriates Monte. He, instead of hearing it and saying, yeah, right, I should be a leader, he goes crazy and decides not to tie his shoes and to storm out of practice. Now, what makes this fantastic is in most practice facilities, they don't let you see anything anymore. But at this one gym that they're at in New York, they're along the stairs that lead to a public gym, a cardio area, it's all open. You can see right into the gym. So not only does all the media see this, all these regular civilians watch Nelson huffing and puffing and Monte storming out of a gym, and it happens in New York. So you know what the media does with that. To me, it was fantastic. It was, and it was right after the team had gone to Milwaukee and let Brandon Jennings scored 55 on him without ever going over a screen, and Steven Jackson demanding a trade. So it was right at the dysfunctional prime of the Golden State Warriors. To me, that story speaks to all of it.
That is a phenomenal story. And to bridge them with an old story, if memory serves, Steven Jackson didn't just demand a trade. He demanded a trade butt naked while wagging certain body parts at Milwaukee Sentinel Journal reporters. So it was a remarkably good time for Monte to throw a temper tantrum.
He sure did, and Steve Jackson makes love to pressure. Let's never forget that.
And he does. What a great place to end it. Huge fun, ladies and gentlemen. True every week, certainly true this week. In fact, I'd go so far as to say we had a jocular time. Please remember, you want to reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any issues you want us to cover on the show, questions, concerns, anything, hit us up on Twitter. That's at Warriors Huddle, or on our email account. That's warriorshuddle@gmail.com. Rusty does have a Twitter account, but you're going to have to work really hard to find it because he won't tell you what it is. Remember, our website is warriorsworld.net, and we're on a bunch of podcasting services, including iTunes. Get out there, rate us, please review us. Even if you hate the show, give us a 5-star review. We really appreciate it. Go Warriors, and hopefully we'll see you next week.
Good.